You're listening to the MoneyWeb Now podcast series with Simon Brown. Live streamed every weekday at 6:30 a.m.
Friday, 27 September, U.S. PCE price index data due later today. It is the Fed's preferred inflation indicator, expected 2.3%, previous 2.5%. I'm Simon Brown, coming at you live and loud from the MoneyWeb studios in Gauteng, Johannesburg. On the show today, Viv Govender from Rand Swiss. China, he'd never been a fan, want to know if that stimulus changes it, and all the big Meta announcement from Wednesday. They really are going big on augmented reality and artificial intelligence. Taryn Sankar, she from Stanlib, understanding the local credit market and where it fits with an investment portfolio. And thoughts for me, cash is king, but how do we best measure it? Free cash flow per share, a good starting point. This podcast is brought to you by Stanlib Asset Management. Invest in more global opportunities through their partnership with JP Morgan Asset Management. Morning headlines, MoneyWeb. FIC says SA could exit the grey list within months, provides an update of progress in restoring the country's financial standing and catching crooks by looking at their bank accounts. Business Day suspended jail sentence for Steinhoff shareholder over insider trading. Yep, 7 years later, he got a tip-off from Marcus Huerta, sold his shares just before they collapsed. Morning markets, US markets were green, S&P up 0.4, NASDAQ up 0.7%. Easter's mostly green. Sydney's down 0.2%. Tokyo's up 0.1%. Hong Kong 3.7% higher, and Tencent up 2% in the lunch break. Commodities mixed. Gold higher at 2,694. Brent 71.34. Platinum higher at 1,016. And palladium 1,038. Rand 17.23. Bitcoin 65,200. And top 40 opening call, another big open, 375 points higher, that is 0.5% in the green.
MoneyWeb Now on the money. Also available on podcast.
I'm chatting with Viv Govender from Rand Swiss. Viv, appreciate the time. You and I, we chat often. You have said in as many words, you don't like China. You consider it uninvestable. We had them come with a giant stimulus on Tuesday. I suspect that doesn't change your picture of anything, but perhaps it raises more concerns.
It does. Look, it's a very simple thing. You know, you can have Donald Trump or you can have Joe Biden or whichever, you know, old person running the U.S. Mm-hmm. And it's really not going to affect the U.S. economy that much. China, however, is very different. You have a old person, basically, who's declining probably at this age, doesn't understand the new economy, doesn't understand how the country he runs actually works properly. And he's going to have a lot more impact on that country. And so you look at CIS, the stimulus coming through, you're seeing huge, you know, share price improvements for some of these, you know, stocks out there. And, you know, that's obviously, you know, good for investors in the short term. But you go long term and you see what that economy is looking like at the moment. Quite frankly, there is very little hope that we're going to see Chinese economy come out of this current, you know, malaise until we see a change in leadership, or at least a change in policy that probably, fortunately, requires a change in leadership at this point in time.
Frankly, a change in political system. But let's move from that. Meta had a big event on Wednesday. And as I was reading about it in the morning, it struck with conversations you and I have had more broadly around AI and the AI fund that you run. But Meta's kind of the sleeping giant here. They've got Llama, I think we had 3.1. That's their large language model. It is open source. They're bringing glasses, which started with Oculus and is now, and then Ray-Bans, the new one, and its name escapes me. They're kind of the sleeping giant here in the augmented reality, artificial intelligence space.
Yeah, and to get an idea of what they're thinking about, Mark Zuckerberg wore a shirt saying all Zuck or nothing. I think it was in German or some other language, but it translated to all Zuck or nothing.
Yeah.
So basically, they've turned a disadvantage into an advantage. By which I mean, they came to this story a bit late. They didn't invent this technology, but they spotted it early enough. In fact, they spotted it earlier than the people that actually invented it, which was Google. Mm-hmm. And they went all in on it. And so they were actually, remember back in the day in the metaverse, thinking about AR and all those kind of things. It just so happened the stuff they were developing then kind of really suited this. So they were developing these Ray-Ban glasses, according to Mark Zuckerberg. And then they saw what the LLMs could do. And then he called somebody up at his company and said, can we do this? And a week later, they had made these glasses based on the LLM, quite frankly. And then he went out and he headhunted the smartest people he could get. They started building this, which was Llama, it was AI. Mm-hmm. And he figured, because I'm behind OpenAI and the other guys, I can't really be competing on that level. What can I do? I can destroy them. If I can't beat them, I can basically destroy them. How? make whatever they are making and giving it away for free.
Yeah.
And that's what he's doing. He's making this Llama stuff and he's giving it away for free. So OpenAI's business model, any other company's business model that works on the idea that they're going to make an LLM that is so good and big people are going to pay them for it, doesn't work when Meta is as good, in some cases better than they are, and it's free. And totally in your control as well, which is very important.
Yeah, it is. And it's, I mean, I run Llama 3.1 on my MacBook Pro. It's an M2, so it's a powerful chip, but it runs well. And at times I prefer the ChatGPT. At times I prefer Claude from Anthropic, but it's certainly up there with those other two. The other thing that Zuckerberg is doing is that push to glasses. And I mean, Google Glasses, maybe almost 18 years old or something. And I remember when it came out, I thought that's an interface, but it kind of went nowhere. Now we're getting some traction for an interface which isn't your phone or your screen. It's just kind of your personal assistant. And now, of course, it's a smart personal assistant.
Yes. And the thing is that I think it's, again, the case of he developed the glasses before AI. So he was looking for more comfort and style. That's why he got the Ray-Ban maker. There's a company that makes Ray-Bans, but also, strange enough, makes pretty much all the glasses in the world. They are almost a monopoly of glasses. So every single glasses brand that you could think of is made by a single company. Can't remember the name of it, quite frankly, it escapes me at the moment. But he hooked up with them and they developed Ray-Ban glasses. And I think that there was no real killer application for this thing until we had AI. And AI right now, like it was the new version of Llama, that's multimodal, which means that it can hear and it can see.
Yeah.
So can you imagine going through the world, having glasses on you, and let's just say you meet somebody for the first time and says, remember that person's name is Andrew and he does this.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? The next time you meet the person, it recalls it for you. Or you can say, reading a sign in some other language, it can do that for you and translate it into English. And in fact, he did an example with a UFC fighter who speaks Spanish, and they were both wearing the glasses, and the guy spoke Spanish, and Mark Zuckerberg spoke English, and they were having a conversation almost, as naturally as you could in the same language. There was a slight delay, of course, as the translation happened, but it was unbelievably easy to do. And this is the thing that's are going to happen if these glasses become, acceptable socially. This is where we get to the next point. The problem with glasses that Google had was that it was not cool. And in fact, people that often went to places like bars with Google glasses on were attacked physically.
Yeah.
Because people thought they were taking pictures. If you can get them to be accepted socially, then this is the new form factor quite easily.
Yeah, I mean, I've seen a pair of Ray-Bans in the wild and they looked a little different, but I didn't know what that difference was until it was pointed out to me. Luxottica, I think, is the name of the company that owns Ray-Ban and all the others, a sunglasses hut and the like. But we leave it there. Viv Govender, Rand Swiss, always appreciate the insights. And that's our poll today, LinkedIn and Twitter, talking around Meta. Are they leading with AR, augmented reality, virtual reality? They bought Oculus many years ago. They've just launched a new Oculus 3S, I think they call it. The glasses, the Ray-Bans, the Orions, and of course, that Llama. Have your vote, have your say, LinkedIn and Twitter. Give you money, smoother returns for Stanlib Asset Management. The Stanlib Flexible Income Fund's agile investment process preserves and grows capital in all markets.
MoneyWeb now, on the money.
I'm chatting with Taryn Sankar, Head of Credit Fixed Income at Stanlib. Taryn, appreciate the time today. The credit market, it's a giant within the sort of fixed income space in South Africa. It's important for investors, but I think far too often we're not fully au fait with what it means when I wave those terms around. So let's start there. What is credit investing in terms of fixed income and how's it changed in the last decade or so?
Thanks so much, Simon. So as you noted, credit is one subcategory of the debt asset class. And in a South African context, we broadly define credit as floating rate debt instruments that are issued by an entity other than the government. So there are two features worth noting here. The first is that floating rate debt instruments means that the cash flows that investors receive from these floating rate securities vary over time as the reference rate rises or falls. And so in a period where rising rates generally depress the value of fixed rate securities, the coupons paid by floating rate securities may increase. And that makes them more stable and attractive in a portfolio, provided there are no defaults, which brings me to the second feature of credit that's worth noting. Unlike government debt, which is deemed to be risk-free, these credit instruments present investors with a level of credit risk, as obligations to pay interest and or repay principal may not be met. And so in exchange for bearing this risk, investors demand a higher yield. On your second point around the key changes in the credit landscape over the past 15 years, I'd characterize them as supply changes and demand changes. Mm-hmm. From a supply perspective, what's been really striking is that there are only a dozen names that are actually regular issuers in the corporate debt market. And so what that means is, while on average we've seen 23 unique corporate issuers over the last decade, we only have seen 13 that have actually issued notes in the last 9 of the past 12 years. And so we really are facing a dearth of new issuers, especially in the corporate credit space. The other feature worth noting from the supply side is, while we might have fewer issuers on average, the credit quality, as measured by the credit rating of these issuers, has actually increased. And so by the end of 2023, more than 80% of the corporate credit market was actually rated AAA and AA, compared to a mere 30% in 2013. So while we have a smaller universe, we certainly are dealing with relatively higher quality corporates. In terms of demand side themes, I think that the rise of multi-asset investing has meant that credit is no longer the purview of specialist fixed income houses. Increasingly, we're seeing it show up in balance fund and multi-asset income funds, which have actually seen a threefold increase in AUM since 2016. The other feature that's noteworthy from a demand side is the rise of bank participation in credit auctions. And this is really a direct response to regulations relating to high-quality liquid assets that are designed to make banks safer following the global financial crisis. And so what we've seen is a sustained trend of banks actually bidding for an average of 25 to 35% of corporate auctions between 2022 and 2024.
Okay, that is giant. I would never have guessed that the banks were involved to that number. As I said up front, I mean, it's a part of the broader sort of fixed income. What do you think is most misunderstood part of the credit investing market, particularly from investors and listeners out there?
I'd say that understanding credit risk in a fixed income fund goes far beyond credit ratings. That tends to be the focus in the discussions that we have with our clients and other stakeholders in terms of the quality of the credit in the fund. But credit as an asset class includes a spectrum of issuer liabilities, ranging from the vanilla, such as investment-grade bonds issued by established corporates, to the more complex, such as credit-linked notes issued by banks. And even within that broad spectrum, credit instruments can be either fixed rate or floating rate. They can be listed or unlisted. They might be secured or unsecured, rated or unrated. And I'm sure this sounds like a lot of jargon to you and your listeners, but there are many nuances when it comes to understanding credit investments. And because of the spectrum of outcomes, it's really important that investors understand exactly what type of credit risk they are exposed to via the funds they own, and crucially, how liquidity and concentration risks are managed in a portfolio context. So I'd really encourage fixed income investors to kind of expand their interrogation beyond credit ratings into liquidity, concentration, and the actual detail of the instruments funds are holding.
That's a great point. I think it's too easy. Oh, AAA, everything's great. It can be AAA, but it could be, as you say, it could be concentration. It could be liquidity. That could be the challenge. We've seen the government. What are we now? We're now, what, 3 months, 3.5 months since the formation of Government of National Unity. What's the impact on that been on fixed income markets in general, and particularly the local credit market?
So we've seen an unwinding of the political risk premium priced into South African 10-year CDS, which have narrowed by close to 90 basis points since April 2024. And what this implies, Simon, is that foreigners are more comfortable holding SA bonds. On average, government yields across the curve are down more than 2% post-GNU, which is sizable, right? From a credit perspective, we've not seen a significant uptick in new issuers or volumes on offer just yet, although we do expect a robust issuance pipeline into 2024. The one area that we're watching out that could be quite a significant beneficiary of GNU-related stability is really around the changing perceptions towards quality state-owned enterprises with strong and stable management teams.
I get your point on that, and particularly around the SOEs. Just to go right back up at the top, when you're saying that these are non-government, does that include, it means it's not state-owned enterprise?
So non-government, it would include state-owned enterprises.
Yeah,
so it's generally corporate state-owned enterprises, banks, securitizations. Those are the types of issues that we talk about when we mention credit.
Looking forward, what are the sort of the key drivers or themes that you're looking to perhaps move credit markets in the next year or so as we sort of go through 25 and into 2026?
Yeah, so a lot of investors and market players expect sizable improvements in the economy's performance if the GNU delivers on the reform agenda that's been promised. And that could lead to a further appreciation of South African assets. Why this is relevant for us as fixed income investors is that confidence, as it translates into higher fixed capital formation, that generally sees corporates kind of pulling out the CapEx projects that they've had on ice for a number of years and returning to capital markets and banks in order to invest that money productively into the economy. And so this return to capital markets, we could see as the cost of capital becomes cheaper, especially as we've seen yields come down. So there's quite a virtuous cycle that could play out if we see momentum in the reform agenda. And then outside of GNU, one of the key drivers that we're looking at post-2025 is the issuance of a new class of bank instruments known as FLAC, which stands for First Loss After Capital. And what's unique about these instruments is that there's a sizable volume of debt that needs to be issued. And it's being phased in from 2025, but this could have an impact on the cost of capital for banks, which has ripple effects into the rest of the economy. So we'll be watching that quite closely as well.
Okay, I mean, we'll do a follow-up on that. I'd never heard of that before, so we'll definitely do a follow-up in time. That's Stanlib Sanka, Head of Credit Fixed Income. Stanlib, really appreciate the time. Give your money the return it wants without taking a flight with the Stanlib Global Select Fund, an offshore equity fund submanaged by JP Morgan Asset Management.
MoneyWeb now on the money.
Ultimately, investing is around cash. And so some thoughts on that today. I mean, we always talk around cash is king. We look at dividends. We can look at cash flow statements. But something I've been doing a fair bit of digging into in the last little while is essentially free cash flow per share. Free cash flow is at the EBIT level. In other words, earnings before interest and tax. And this is before, there's a lot more still to be paid off, but it is that EBIT, and it's not depreciations and amortizations, because of course they are non-cash items. So you get the sort of the EBIT number, and you divide by the number of shares, and it gives an indication of actual cash relative to the share price. And that's what I quite like about it. You can, for example, overlay the free cash flow per share on the NVIDIA share price, on the Meta share price. Those are just two I quickly pulled out. But even locally, in the US, it works better in many senses because we get quarterly results. In South Africa, they're only biannual. But even when I look at the likes of a ShopRite, suddenly when you overlay this free cash flow per share on the share price, you realize that perhaps pricing isn't so wildly out of kilter. Now, we can debate whether they are expensive or not, but you look at NVIDIA, and the 10x rise in the share price in the last 2 years is absolutely underpinned by free cash flow per share. It comes through very, very much. We see similar happening with Meta. Of course, what then happens with that cash? Some of it will go to CapEx, some of it will go to debt, some to interest, and finally, some of it will go to dividends. And we'll see companies like ShopRite, who pay out perhaps a more chunky dividend. The two I mentioned earlier, Meta and NVIDIA, less so. They're both new to the world of paying dividends. They've been spending wildly on internal growth and CapEx. Meta's dividend yield, 0.35%. If you think that is stingy, NVIDIA's dividend yield, 0.03%. That's it for today. I was chatting with Warren Wheatley yesterday. He's the CEO at Altvest Capital. They're doing an IPO, essentially moving from the Cape Town Stock Exchange across to the JSE. We asked if you were taking part in the listing. Almost half said not. A third said you were looking for more info, while the rest were saying absolutely, you are loving it. The show is brought to you by Stanlib Asset Management. Invest in more certainty to navigate volatile market conditions. We're live every weekday morning. The MoneyWeb website's in the app at 6:30 a.m. Podcast just after 7 a.m. Thanks to my team, Eddie, Nobuchle, Nicole, to you for listening. My guests for their time. My name is Simon Brown. This is MoneyWeb Now. If you're loving the show, please leave us an awesome rating and a positive review in your podcatcher of choice. We'll chat again Monday, making cash profitable.
You've been listening to another MoneyWeb Now podcast, posted every weekday at 7 a.m. on moneyweb.co.za. MoneyWeb Now, on the money.